Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Biz Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, I'm talking with Scott Laguerre and Jay Coyle, who are music business educators and entrepreneurs. Scott is the head of the Music Business Department at McNally Smith College of Music. He has a long history of founding companies, teaching classes, playing music, and recording bands. Jay is the founder of Music Geek Services, a music marketing and digital strategy agency for artists. He also teaches music business classes at Berklee Online. A few weeks ago, the three of us attended the Future of Music Policy Summit in Washington, D.C. I sat down with Jay and Scott after the conference for dinner. We had a couple drinks and we recorded a podcast. I really hope you enjoy this discussion. Occasionally, you may hear a little bit of background noise from the restaurant. Please forgive the clinking of glasses and the ambience. As always, make sure that you subscribe to Music Biz Podcast in iTunes and on SoundCloud. And if you love the show, please rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. This will help us reach a wider audience and allow other people to discover the show. Without further ado, here is today's episode. So we spent the last 2 days attending panels at the Future of Music Policy Summit here in Washington, D.C. I'd like to hear, what was one of your biggest takeaways from the event?
I think for me, having just spent a week or several days here at Future Music, it has to be community. If you look at all the challenges that artists are facing, whether it's a challenge of monetization, whether it's a challenge of marketing and understanding and legal support, the ability to come together, talk about these issues within a large group, align ourselves with best practices and have that networking in the hallway, have that networking in the back of the room. Community is critical if we're going to bring everybody up together to understand how to deal with today's impact.
Jay, how about you? What was your biggest takeaway from the event?
Mine was, for lack of a better term, activism, because it's the type of thing where I sat there and was truly motivated to, how do I make a change here? How do we make a change? And I don't want to say that I don't think about that regularly. Like, I would love this to happen or love that to happen. But I just felt after the last 2 days, there was this, you know, to your point, there was that community coming together mentality. But it truly was, we have to act, because my fear is if we don't act, then there's no solution. And so I walk away from just that energy of, okay, how do we make a difference? How can I act on that?
A unique thing about Future Music is that if you're in your hometown, in your home community, you're facing these things in isolation. You're frustrated on a daily basis. Who do you reach out to? You come together with some of the wonks and other policymakers that attend things like Future Music. You realize, okay, I'm not in this alone. There's a lot of other people dealing with these issues. And if you talk and you coordinate, you might actually, to your point, be able to build an action plan. Okay, what can we do? There really does need to be some activism type of solutions for the challenges we're facing. And I think that's the excitement of conferences like this. Is you come together, you align, you understand where we're at, and realize some of this isn't, I'm just being dumb in my hometown. And, you know, it's not ignorance. It's not lack of trying that's a challenge for a lot of people. There are some real policy issues. There's some real legal issues. There's some technological issues that if we all worked together to solve them, they would probably help mitigate a lot of the challenges that we face in isolation back in our hometowns.
So when you go back to your hometown in the Twin Cities, what are some ways that you would like to bring your learnings back to the community and try to activate the people who live there today?
One of the issues has to be around streaming, right? We look at one constituency and streaming is the worst thing ever, and it's destroying the record business and you're never going to make a penny from it, right? Everyone was quoting that 0.00. X percent is what you get per stream. Realizing, okay, how can we solve the streaming issue? Is it a platform that we can use for promotion? Are there some legislative solutions that would help pay out the accurate amounts? That's just one of them. And I think a big challenge is for a lot of working musicians, they're not well versed on these issues. They don't see granularly how technology and other things are affecting their day-to-day. They might just notice playing 7 gigs a week. They might just be noticing deep in the trenches, you know, I don't have X in my statement that I used to. Being able to come back and sort of shape the debate for them and then inspire others to maybe activate, as Jay was saying, whether it's letter writing, whether it's a variety of things.
And Jay, you're going to be going back to Nashville. What are some ways that you would like to activate the Nashville community and bring some of your learnings from the Future Music Policy Summit back home?
Yeah, for me, like I said, activism, I instantly, listening to the panel and Jeff Boxer from C3, which is the Content Creators Coalition, I'm an idiot. I never even knew that thing existed. So here I am, you know, thinking I'm in the music business. I didn't even know that existed. So to me, that was a touch point. I went, okay, I'm A, Jeff's in Nashville, but B, I'm going to make sure that I'm teaching through Berklee Online, what I teach at. I'm going to make sure that I'm educating my students that this thing exists, because that to me is the cornerstone for activism, to get involved. And he was on his panel. He was motivating everybody in the audience to write your local politician and write your congressman. And there wasn't, for me, I felt like, wow, there wasn't enough people saying that at the conference. And maybe that's just not the vibe of it. This is my first time here. But at the same token, I walk away going, it doesn't really matter what else somebody does. It's what I'm going to do. So I was really motivated to connect with Jeff.
Another fun part of FMC is you have so many different individuals and stakeholders from all of these companies, whether it's labels, whether it's publishers, whether it's tech firms. They came here. And suddenly it's not where you're talking about Bandpage in isolation. You're actually meeting with somebody like Kevin, and that goes on down the line. You realize all of these companies that you might see as a banner ad on your favorite music blog, they are people. They are all mostly musicians. They've started these companies to solve various problems. And so just the ability to take that shared learning of, listen, we've got these 5 companies. They've got a great product that solves this level of solution for musicians. If we all adopt these or learn how to use them, they can impact us in these ways. That was hugely formative for me, and I can't wait to bring that back to my classrooms in my state.
So you said something interesting, which is that you'd like to, you know, educate the students about this conference and really kind of advocate that they attend. You know, there are some really weighty issues that got brought up at this conference. A lot of it, you know, is so technical and complex that I think even we are still kind of trying to wrap our heads around all just the myriad of problems and issues that maybe don't necessarily have immediate solutions. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to go from a level of, you know, we're learning about the music business and its different parts. We're learning about how to read contracts and what they say. We're learning how to market our music and how to promote it, how to build and engage with our audiences, maybe, and let alone to learn how to just play music better or manage our band as a contributor. Now, you know, you bring into that world all of these other, even more complex issues that are impacting you as an artist that you probably had no idea existed until you attended this conference. What do you think you would tell a student to kind of prepare them before they're about to attend? How would you try to outline these issues for them? And, you know, let them know that, yes, you know, already what we've gone through is like a huge educational journey, but there is just so much more going on that I really want to expose you to.
One of the things that's come up a lot in my classes recently is last week finished the whole conversation about the conversion rate from digital and from physical to digital and just where it's going from the streaming capacity. And a lot of my students were sharing their views on, well, I used to buy CDs or I used to download on iTunes, and now I'm going to Pandora and now I'm going to Spotify, you know, insert their choice, or some saying, I don't like streaming. And it was more focused on them as the user experience. So I wanted to channel that conversation, and I tried to set it up where I was giving them the context of where the industry came from. You know, I'm a 47-year-old guy and I'm a vinyl junkie, but there was a time where I converted from vinyl to CD, you know? And so, and it was educating them how things have evolved over time. And I was trying to have them envision where we came from, where we are now, and then the future that we can help create together. And a lot of it is an educational process beyond the context. It's setting it up so that it isn't that the streaming services are these evil beasts and they're out to, you know, take money from the artist. And some of that's the press that you hear. You hear, well, we're, you know, artists aren't getting paid enough. Well, that's true to some extent, but it's more of an educational, once again, process to, I would equip my students to say, hey, if you come to this policy summit, you're going to be exposed to the big challenges that the industry as a whole is looking at, and then break it down into little pieces where it is a matter of how does this affect me as an independent artist? And then, you know, I think an independent artist is going to look at, and they should, their direct immediate effect that they can help change or how they're affected by these changes in the industry. And it's just giving them the bigger framework, if you will, of, okay, we're going to talk about this, and this is going to build on top of this and build on into the building blocks. But like I said, it's really setting them up to see the bigger picture of how the industry is in such flux. It doesn't mean the sky is falling. And it is that concept of community again, where we are all in this together, because we do want to see a music business be successful for years to come. And how does that then affect these indie artists that most of my students are?
Well, and in many ways, you could say you start to realize no one has it all figured out. There are still a lot of complexities that have come about all these changes, don't you think, Scott?
Well, absolutely. And there's a couple of educational tools and pedagogies that you can fall back on. And there's that classic totem that you tell students what you're going to tell them. You tell them, and then you tell them what you just told them. You know, you're right, Kyle. These are some huge issues, and you guys touched on all of these. It's a challenge to reach students. I try every day at McNally Smith. You don't build a band overnight. You don't build a brand overnight. And also, as a learner or young practitioner, you don't understand all of the complexities of an industry this large in one semester or even one course. I mean, it's time. There's a reason why we've design bachelor's degrees and such to be 4 years. I think Mike King did a great job reminding us about fandom. You know, you need awareness, and then you need to broach that contact level, and then you need to build a relationship, and then you need to build sales. You know, I joke about grocery stores all the time. If you want to sell fancy cheese, you need to have a taster for the cheese. You need to start that dialogue. And I think at the very least, if we can go back to our home communities, our home schools, and start the dialogue, present to young people, you live in an ecosystem, which is a tough concept to understand. How important, you know, right now you might not be selling product. You're a young band. Guess what? The record store on the corner, they matter, you know, and you might not be a heavy radio listener. You might be already tuned into a variety of apps, but your local radio station, the Current in the Twin Cities, is a huge resource. Even if you're not directly engaged with them now, you can be down the road. And what are we always trying to do is set building blocks and set a foundation for later personal growth, later exploration, as a student or young professional becomes more invested in all of these issues and in their career. They've been introduced about, okay, how can I push the ball forward in my own court? How can I get more activated where I'm at? Hopefully we're able to do that in the coming weeks and months within our classes.
Well, and in many ways, most students aren't making any money from their music yet to begin with. So they have a lot more to worry about in terms of learning how to, you know, not just, you know, continue to make music and find collaborators that they can either work with or form a band with, but also all of the tools along the way in learning how to record, produce, and distribute their music, let alone promote, market, and evangelize. And only later on do you start getting to the stage of, like, you know, now we are selling a significant amount of music, or, you know, now it's being streamed to a greater extent. Then you start wondering even more, and now where is the money?
It's almost Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? I mean, there is a natural progression, and you just described it, Kyle, that you need to be pulled through or encouraged through all these pieces. And once you add to every skill set and you're building upon that, eventually you'll be in a position to understand and have a better grasp of these issues.
And I, you know, my look at this, as you guys know, I mean, I was on a direct to fan panel. It's where my brain automatically goes to, and it's direct to fan by tagline, but it's truly serving fans, right? So I look at it from a challenge of my purpose here was I was listening to everything about from an activism level, what I'm going to do and how I'm going to motivate. But it's still, I do want to go back and look at what can I do, because I look at things so differently. I do look at the fans first. So what's one, I felt that there was one, I'd say I didn't think it was missing. Obviously, we spoke about it on my panel and I said the words. It's like, I want to bring the humanistic element to the fact that the data we're talking about or the numbers we're talking about, there's a human being behind that. And I'm not talking about the artist that's making the music. I'm talking about the fan that's connecting with that music. So that's the reality of it, is all true artists are music fans at the heart of it, right? It's like all three of us can talk about, as we've shared on the way here, like there's a reason why we do what we do. There's a song, there's a band, there's a concert experience that we connected with. Well, that's an artist. I'm a drummer, you know, like I can think about the first time I wanted to play drums and the fact I was motivated to do that. And the first bands I was in, it's like, there's my story, there's my path. So we have to remember that a music fan is going to have those same emotions. They're going to have that connection. So, you know, and to me, the education is not only the policies and the business structure. I do want to always make sure that I'm teaching my students that it does start with them writing that song, but them finding a way to make sure that they're being authentic in connecting with fans, because the business will build genuinely, organically, and scalable from a scalable standpoint if you truly keep connecting with fans.
I thought one of the high points in terms of optimism for the conference was actually when a music student took the microphone and pointed out exactly what you're speaking to, Jay, that what he was most excited about coming from a fan perspective is take 20-somethings today who have grown up immersed in social media, who have grown up immersed in a collaborative and, you know, open table conversation piece. He's excited about today's tools because they let him engage with artists at such a deeper level. Again, we often talk about from an industry side that technology is so challenging and confusing. And seconds ago, we were talking about, well, the artist has to be up on the recording and the this. And the, we just created a laundry list of 110 things that an artist has to do. But some of those very same pieces of technology are allowing fans to get excited and get engaged at maybe even deeper levels than ever before. Sure, you had the, you know, you had the Kiss fan club in 71 and you got the decoder ring, but now you can go so much deeper, so much sooner based on, you know, you're sharing long form essays on Tumblr and Medium, and you're sharing place and excitement of where you're at and what you're seeing via Instagram. There's all these levels of deep interaction. And I've never thought about it that way, that this is also a huge advantage for fans to be so deeply related to their artists, that is a great long-term solution.
Jay, you're a music marketer. You work with a number of acts. How do you encourage these deeper interactions to occur between the artists that you manage and the fans that love them?
Well, like I said, I come from it from a fan's perspective, you know. Scott, you mentioned the Kiss Army fan club. It's like, I so badly wanted to join, but I didn't have any money. And my mom was like, you don't need to join the fan club. But, you know, here I was the age of 7 or 8. And I instantly went, but that's how I identify myself, right? I identify myself through the music that I'm connecting with. And then it progressed well beyond the Kiss Army and certain bands I connected with. But I really make it a point when I meet with the bands that either I'm working with or I want to work with. And we have that commonality where I say, let's talk about what motivates you as a musician, you know, what, and start it from their point of view to say, who's important to you? And instantly they become a super fan and they tell me, I love this band. And then we connect on it. And I take that energy and then I turn it back on them in a positive sense. I said, great. Let's take that energy that you have for the Descendants, Mr. Chris Murphy from Sloan. And we geeked out on the fact that we loved Minor Threat and the Descendants. And I know his heart. I know his passion for his art. He wants to have his fans feel the same way for his band that he does for these other bands. So then I try to kind of, like I said, my business model is one that I work with the artists to serve their fans. And you have to have that connection. And I think, to me, I'm not focused on being the next Nicki Minaj or the next Taylor Swift. I don't want to work with those acts. That's just not where I'm at. I love working with the bands that know who they are as an artist, and they have a fan base, and I just making sure that there is that constant contact, connection, engagement, and that we're constantly feeding those fans the content, the music, the live experience that those fans want.
So earlier in the conversation, Jay, you had this great point where a student asked you, Jay, can you market a band that you're not passionate about? What did you tell them?
It was one of those things where I read it. It was typed in a chat to me, and I read it. And as I'm reading it out loud to my class in my web chat, I just kind of went, oh, because I knew they weren't going to want to hear what I had to hear. And that was, well, if you're working for somebody and you're paid a salary to do marketing, and at one time I was employed by a label and I had to market stuff, the answer would have to be, I would have to say, yes, I have to market that. But where I live now, and I think the beautiful thing about being an entrepreneur in the music business, and I think being the beautiful thing about being an artist, is the freedom. A good friend of mine who's a buddy of mine in Nashville, he has built two or three companies. And he said to me, it was never about building the company. It was never about building money or security or whatever, fame, whatever. He said, I wanted freedom. I wanted to do what I did, and I gave myself freedom to succeed. And if I had failure, I had failure. But when I succeeded and I therefore had money in the bank, I was then going, I'm free. I don't have to do anything I don't want to. So I said to the student, it's like, I want you to get to a point where you can be honest and say, me personally, Jay Coyle, I cannot manage, market, project manage, whatever the term is that I work on with an artist, unless I truly, truly connect with their music. Because I just, it's inauthentic to me. And that's the point of the issues that I have with certain labels, be it major indies. If I see music coming out that I don't connect with, I'm like, okay, but then there's something else in that label that I really connect with. I kind of go, are they being authentic? Is it, eh? But I just can't work with acts that don't touch me.
And back to the fan thing for a second, and back to a level of optimism with this whole industry. This is one of the most powerful forms of communication on the planet. And if I think back to future FMCs that I've attended years ago, when Facebook was still relatively new, it was shared that, and the statistic is somewhere around 88 or 89% of users on Facebook, which is obviously now a 1.5 billion individual platform, 88 to 89% of them were listing musical acts within their profile, which shows you exactly what you were relating to a second ago, Jay, that 90% of the people on the planet use music as a self-identifier. You know, whether you are in the Kiss Army, whether you were at this concert, were you there when, you know, which means back to the, there's an excitement with the notion of having to market music. Do you really have to market it? If people love it and there is such a demand for it, do you have to market it, or do you just have to line it up and present it to the right crowd? You know, it's more a strategy of sharing, or careful sharing, or curated sharing, than actually having to be a guy smiley and go out and hawk something. And it's always healthy and exciting to be reminded of that, you know, we're not trying to throw widgets into the wind. We're really dealing with something that to humanity is critical and valued. So then it's just the Rubik's Cube of how to get your piece of that humanity to that niche. And there you go.
It's funny. You touched on something that really just hit me. It's like, you're right. I actually consider myself a marketer. I teach music marketing. But yet one word that keeps getting used, and I heard it today from a new person that I met. They're like, man, you're so passionate. So I appreciate that. It's like, great. Well, I market through passion. And I know that that's not typical, because you're right. I mean, marketing, if it's really, really good and it resonates, then you don't need to market it. And somebody said earlier today on the panel, you know, the cream will rise. And if it's really good, it's going to be shared. And if it's really good, everybody's going to want to be a part of it, or touch it, or engage with it, or hear it and love it. Well, that's kind of the way that I operate. It's like, if I truly believe in the bands, as I just said, it's like, I truly believe in these bands. I'm really not marketing them. I'm just figuring out, how do I tell the story or share this to the right people so that they connect with it? And the world that I live in is legacy and artist management. And I'm working with bands that are inactive, or they're becoming inactive or less active, whatever the term is you want to use. But it has a fan base already. And I go, great. Then how do I serve those fans? So I come at it a place of, I want to serve them. And to me, serving a fan is not marketing. It's not. But I have to use the term marketing when I explain it to people, that all they think about is units or, you know, identifiers or whatever. It's like, I'm just serving the fans.
In many ways, your passion can be transformed into evangelism. And beyond that, your job is to spark that feeling in other people. They get excited about it. They get lit up. And all of a sudden, they're the ones telling their friends about that artist. And ultimately, that's how you build, you know, these groups of fans who form these tribes around these artists and build that sense of community around that, that content and that personal identity that they associate with being a part of that group, and the people that are surrounded by them.
Exactly. And, you know, Jay and Kyle, that was both a perfect example. And I'm thinking, you know, did Steve Jobs ever sell to us? Did he ever market to us? Or did he just stand on stage and beam like a proud father? And I remember, you know, I watched all those keynotes live, watching them sit there with, you know, the V1 of the iPad and say, just, isn't this cool? And he was genuinely excited as he's showing people, you're surfing the web with your fingers. You know, some of our best companies, if we look at it, no, they never had to market. They never had to sell. They just had to be excited, and that turned them into evangelists. And it's a really natural thing. And back to this fan potential today, if you engage with these fans and all of these tools, and this is the great thing about the internet, it is not one way. It is not a singular portal. It is two-way. User-generated content is the bulk of the internet. If you excite a human being, if you excite a music fan, they will be your evangelist. So you're not a DIY artist. You are not operating in a vacuum. And even if you're small, there are 100 people who would kill to be on your team tomorrow. All you need to do is really activate them and energize them with some marching orders, and they're going to run to the street. And then if we take these big issues that we're struggling with, whether it's, you know, rights issues here or database clearances here, whatever it might be, you also excite your fans into activism around some of these things. We probably have the people and the momentum to make some serious change, whether it needs to be legislative, whether it needs to be individually campaigned. There's a lot of momentum behind what we do. You know, so we're a dying industry. We had members from the Beggars Group at the conference, and while it wasn't discussed at FMC, we all now know what the statistics have been for Adele within the first 24 hours of that release. That's exciting for everybody. That's great news for everybody. When you're hitting a million spins an hour, and, we just have to excite people. And even if your pool, your fan pool is smaller, that same level of activation and excitement and social sharing can happen.
Increasingly, you know, both streaming services are trying to think about when a fan discovers an artist and they get lit up and they start, you know, listening to the song on repeat, at what point in time should the management or the record label be able to go, whoa, you know, these people right here are getting lit up by this song. How do we tell them about, you know, the latest merchandise or the fact that there's a tour nearby? How are we going to take the fans who are inside of these platforms and, you know, bring them out to shows and turn them into buyers, right?
Not working for any of those services, I don't have the most immediate answer, but I think another thing that came out of this conference is a lot of the challenges we're facing are just for now, right? So thinking about streaming services, I'm reminded of our PROs. We're one of the few countries that has multiples. Well, what's happened because we have ASCAP and BMI and CSAC on some level competing for the same space? Well, we now have events. You know, we have the ASCAP I Create Music Expo. They might not have had to do that to celebrate their heritage and their artists if there was less competition. You know, the PROs all offer a variety of healthcare plans. They offer a variety of gear insurance plans for musicians, which aren't covered under normal renters insurance policies. You know, you let competition come into the marketplace and you are going to see more and more functionality come to all of these sites where it will be possible. And, you know, I love Shazam now, that when I Shazam a thing, if I scroll down, I'm going to get some biographical information. I'm going to find out that, you know, Clark Terry was playing on that track, or Ray Brown was playing the keyboards on that track, whatever it might be. For the fan, those are the rabbit holes we love to go down. And I think very soon we won't look at streaming services and call them streaming services. We'll look at them and call them platforms, because akin to Pandora buying Ticketfly, there's going to be a lot more functionality, and there's going to be a lot more inherent, whether it's push notification or just available information. It's going to be rich, and you won't have to leave to find out all kinds of information that engenders you to become a deeper fan.
You know, spot on there, Scott. One thing that I look at is what excites me about what Pandora is doing and knowing Jason Feinberg and hearing what he's saying about they are going to take their platform with these, you know, tons, and I don't even remember what the number was he said, but, you know, they're active users on this platform, and it's a non-interactive platform. I say that I want to listen to Sloan Radio, and bam, I'm not listening to Sloan. I might hear one song, and then I'll hear, you know, three or four different bands. But the fact that, A, it's a discovery platform, it excites me, and B, the fact that then you have the ticket fly purchase. So therefore, they're going to say, great, now if you like this band, guess what? They're coming to your town. And like you said, the push notifications and all that, that's, say what you will about Pandora and how little they pay. Trust me, yes, I understand that's an issue. To me, you can pay me 0.00006 cents for a stream of a Sloan song, but if I can sell a ticket, or I can sell a t-shirt, or I can get an email sign up, or I can have you say, I like you and I'll follow you now, so I can then push to you, as a manager, I go, that's what I want from my streaming service.
And again, some of these challenges really are just for now. I mean, how often have audiophiles and music producers rightfully complained about the sound of MP3? Well, we now have Tidal, and guess what? I think it sounds fantastic. But what do we also know? You know, people have already put screenshots of Apple beta pages online showing that there's going to be a button for high def at some point, I'm sure. And I bet at some point Spotify will do the same thing. That's exciting. I mean, I'm inherently impatient. And, you know, seismic things happen in this industry on a daily basis that makes you a little paranoid and a little urgent. But you long view it a little bit, and you look at the panic and the confusion that was ensuing around 2004, 2005, when all we were looking at was negative 14% revenue numbers and that sort of thing, we're at a much different place. Well, what if we give it five more years? You know, we're at 50 million paid streaming subscribers now. Where's it going to be in five more years? Where's it going to be in 18 months? And where's the functionality level going to be of all these companies? Or what other player is going to step into the space that does something from the ground up that's not just streaming, but is fan engaged and things like this? What if Facebook turns on this button? What if a Vine or a Twitter, or again, a new player turns on a music button? It's exciting. And I think we will slowly, some things will be solved quickly, some things will be solved slowly, but like the arc of human humanity, we've generally seen progress over time.
In many ways, it's really still the early days for the digital music sector and, you know, all of these online streaming services. And it's funny because, you know, we're 15 years in. Rhapsody was founded in December of 2000, I believe. And if you ask Tim Quirk or you talk to John Maples, two of the executives who were there since the beginning, more or less, you know, they'll tell you, like, you know, we thought at the time that this would happen a lot sooner. We really thought we were sitting on the music service that would go mainstream. We really thought the, you know, $9.99 a month price point was going to captivate a bunch of people to say, wow, you know, I can get all the music that I want for that price each month. I'm going to do that. I'm not going to file share. I'm not going to buy music. I'm going to sign up for Rhapsody. You know, unfortunately, looking at Rhapsody in present day, you know, they still have like an impressive amount of subscribers. They have roughly 3 million people signed up to the service. But when you compare it to a service like Spotify, who I believe in present day has 15 million subscribers, probably edging on 20 million, and something like 60 to 80 million free users on their service, all of a sudden you look at Raps and you go, oh, you know, Spotify has really just shot past you. And, you know, it's becoming kind of less clear, like, whether or not they're going to be able to catch up, or if there's going to be some level of, you know, acquisition by another company, either some type of, you know, phone maker or communications company, or, you know, who knows, Dish Network or something wants to just bundle it all up. So it's easy to forget, like, we still have more time, you know, inevitably we still have more time. And we are seeing progress, as we've been talking about for the last couple minutes. You know, if you would have, you know, rewinded a few years even, the whole conversation in the music industry was about how streaming music services were being unfair to artists, the royalty payments were so minuscule. And, you know, in an effort to combat, you know, many of those concerns, these services have spun up these artist services teams that are distributing data to artists, giving the information about what's happening on the service, who their fans are, and, you know, how they can act upon that data, whether that's, you know, potentially marketing to them, as I'll get to, or just understanding where they are and where they should consider touring to. Now, on top of that, you have Pandora, who is allowing artists to record voice messages that are going directly in the ears of fans and telling them, hey, you know, this is Odessa. We're going to be touring at the venue next month. Come out and see us. And I believe their VP of Music Maker Strategy said that they are selling out those shows extremely quickly with high velocity. And now this is going to be something that is rolled out to all of the other artists on the service. They're going to be able to, you know, record these audio messages, tell fans about their shows, and increasingly, depending on, you know, if they have a relationship with Ticketfly, it's just going to be one click to buy those tickets, especially if they have their credit card information on deck at Pandora. So, you know, it really is exciting times. And it's only going to accelerate as services are going to continue to power the industry to leverage these platforms, connect with these fans, and help both artists and labels monetize these relationships.
You went down a path that really caught me, because I'm thinking the fact that, yes, it's been 15 years since Rhapsody was saying those things, but I instantly remember Steve Jobs when he was launching the iTunes store and his public announcement, and they're going through the thing, and he said flat out, people don't want to rent their music, they want to own it. And I have to admit, I agreed with him, and I was like, you're right, I don't want to rent, I want to own, because I have a huge, I'm an obsessive music geek, I have a huge record collection and a huge CD collection. I went, yeah, I want to own. But you know what? Over the years, now we're realizing everything that these streaming services are offering, from a point of the advantage to my students, I say, look, it's a, as we talked about earlier, it's a promotional tool, but also as a consumer, it is great to have in my pocket any band that I want to turn my kids onto, or any band that we're sitting here geeking out on stuff, having some drinks, we start talking about, we love REM, we love blah, 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 and we want to play it. I can do that right here, right now. You know, that's crazy. That is the greatest technology to me. But here's the point. It's an and, right? So the technology's there, but we don't have to give up the old model completely. And I think what's interesting is there's still so many people that are, it took us 15 years to get to the point for people to release that fear of letting go of the old music business model. But as I said, it's an and, meaning I can still make CDs. I can make vinyl. Oh, okay. I can make a cassette. I can still have a tangible physical good, but it's an and to all of my fans and my artists that I work with. I'm not talking only streaming, and streaming will be an access point for new ears, old ears, casual listeners, super fan listeners, because it's not just going to be the music that's there. It's going to be the ticket opportunity. It's going to be the communication opportunity, the fan engagement opportunity, which makes that whole channel completely different from the old model, because now it's not just a product. It's a lot bigger to that.
And there's even a piece of this as educators for both of us, Jay, that we consider that one of the things that we have to be bringing into the classroom is also an awareness of the time frame. Right. And you're right. Things were so radically different 15 years ago. But take the long view, you know, Reed Hastings named his company Netflix, not DVD mailed to you.net. Right. I mean, so while when Netflix launched, that functionality wasn't there yet. But, you know, those guys saw the writing on the wall and anticipated. And I think all of us need to see that there is a writing on the wall that's much more engrossing, much more engaging, and really rich, and lots of content sharing, where all of these services become platforms and exciting places to share, not just a place that's going to be criticized for a low valuation of music. I really liked, and I want to bring this to all of my students, Tim Quirk, who has a band that was signed to Warner's. He pointed out, you know, songs do not have inherent value. They probably don't. It's then up to the creator to then proselytize, build, share, grow, any word you want to attach to that, to make these songs over time have greater value to some community or some audience. You know, it is, we are all learning to play a little longer of a long game. You know, we've always talked about career. I think it really means that now, and it's going to be multi-opportunity. It's going to be multi-revenue. But I'm very specifically reminded to bring this back to the classroom that, you know, I'm teaching a class in entrepreneurship, and, you know, people are throwing down business plans that X is going to happen tomorrow. Okay, you're still onto a great idea, but what is the time it's going to take to activate this? It might be years. And again, a healthy conversation that you've brought today, Jay, Kyle, you've mentioned is this has to start with audience. So before you even sell, you have to be broadening the awareness of what you do. And this could be a long game. But good news is, as we continue to fight through and work through, some of the complaints of our industry, some of the shortcomings will grow with us and be much more powerful and, you know, only be more leverageable in the future.
Absolutely. And those are very powerful things to take back to the classroom. You really do have to play the long game. You have to think about the present time frame that we're in. And, you know, maybe your idea that you're thinking about isn't necessarily something for right now, but the time may come when that is the exact moment to, you know, potentially found that business or work on that project or, you know, form a certain partnership.
This was discussed yesterday at the first day of FMC, and I really believe this almost out of consternation. We're not in the music business anymore. We are in such a crowded environment. We really are fighting for attention. And I don't want to think we're fighting. Again, there's so many points of optimism that there's a huge audience out there, but we are in an audience business, right? And at some level, you are trying to eck away your own little space with human beings away from other brands, other bands, other messages that are out there. This is an audience business. So if there's an activation time for your brilliant idea that's a year out, you need to have the perspective that still trust is the number one driver for a purchase decision. You have to start building that trust right away. You have to start engaging in conversation right away. The time to build your audience is now. So when your product does come to fruition, when that record is finished, when you are ready to share this new work of art, there's an audience already behind you to take advantage of that.
And a music business degree, at the end of the day, is almost a degree in disruption. It was one of the first businesses to face all of these changes, and all of the other businesses are now grappling with the things that the music business has been shaped by, you know, for the last 15 years. So as you have been saying, you know, not only is, you know, nowhere safe, this education in the music business isn't just about the music business. It's about, you know, digital disruption. It's about something scarce becoming abundant. It's about really the kind of evolution of artist to fan relationships and even actor to fan relationships. Anyone with a public profile has now been challenged about how they react to this audience that is now there that can immediately and directly comment on anything that they do in real time. And, you know, if they share something that is unsavory, it could take on an entire life of its own overnight, right? Another thing that, you know, we started talking about is, it's not just about, you know, music and business. It's music as a vehicle that enables and inspires creativity. And creativity is something that ultimately transfers over to all different types of endeavors that one is going to find themselves in as they kind of attempt to kind of enter the music business and make a career. Because what does everyone need? They need ideas. And those ideas are born out of creativity. They're about making connections across disciplines. And they're about, you know, forming collaborations and partnerships with the right people that are going to help bring this idea to the world. And, you know, Panos Panay of Berkeley Ice is a huge advocate for this idea that, you know, being a musician teaches you a lot of things about being an entrepreneur. And so many of the things that make a great musician do transfer over to being a great entrepreneur.
Oh yeah. And I've said over and over again, like I didn't get into the music business to think of myself as an entrepreneur, but quickly as I lost the job here, I lost the job there, I lost the job at a record label, I instantly said, well, I'm going to create something out of nothing because I have to do this. So I became an entrepreneur because I didn't have the infrastructure to support myself. So I was like, well, then if, meaning I don't have a job anymore, so I have to do something. But like a true artist, I'm a drummer and I'm used to the fact I have to contribute my part. I kind of went, okay, what can I do and how can I move this forward? But I was really, you talked about Panos. I really liked how he was talking about the concept of the entrepreneurship program and the teaching of creativity. You know, and I do look at my students in Berkeley and it's like, then I look at my own three children. I want them to be creative and be learning how to problem solve and how to look at things differently. And if they're given the opportunity to be creative through a love and appreciation of music and or be a musician themselves, then becomes an inherent, an innate part of them that goes, oh, I can be creative. I can make this up. I can do this. I can do this. It's problem solving. It's creation. It's, you know, looking at my young son who's eight, I look at him and I'm like, okay, he's still in that role of, he still likes to, I don't want to say make believe, but you know, he will regurgitate a story that he heard and he'll say, well, dad, the perfect example, a friend of mine, John Strom, and I was talking about John to my son, Finn. And he said, well, dad, I have a friend named John. I was like, oh, he's like, yeah, my friend, John Sloan. Well, I work with Sloan, the band. So he made his version of my story. It was like he was rewriting the story. He's being really creative. And then he went, as I would say, he just basically kept going down that path, making up this great story. He was so creative. And I was like, that is awesome. He's being creative. But to me, that says to me, I'm giving him an environment and he's being taught in school. It's creativity and he's dreaming and he's thinking. It's like, okay, and as an 8-year-old, you want that. But as an 80-year-old or as a 28-year-old, as a 38-year-old, I want to see that in him. You know, I want to see him always being creative and always thinking that way. So I love the concept of looking at an artist as an entrepreneur. And then the reverse of that is looking at entrepreneurs and allow them to be artists. And it may not be music. It might be another form, but it is. Let's say music is an art form. So you have to talk about the arts and how important the arts are to creativity, whether you do it yourself or you're just exposed to it. It's an important part of the conversation.
You know, there's no one in education now who can't be thinking about the cost of higher education, who can't be joining the conversation on student debt. And Jay, you were just hitting on this. I really hope that the students that go to any of our schools, whether it's Berkeley, whether it's McNally-Smith or any of the other great programs in the country, I hope they're focusing on that this is a degree. Sure, Kyle, it's in disruption, or it's a degree in creativity. It's a degree in fundamentals. You know, we're talking disruption in business planning and strategy simply through the case study of music. You know, as both of you were sharing, I was reminded, you know, Hilton just had a big piece in the New York Times where they're struggling to or racing to launch an app and reclaim the customer conversation that Expedia and other aggregators have taken away from them. They want to know their customers and supersell to them in the same way all of us. I mean, again, we were the canary in the coal mine. This is now every brand on the planet. Everybody is struggling with some very, very similar issues. So what's encouraging to me, being in the education space and knowing that it's expensive for students at McNally-Smith, hopefully they're taking away some fundamentals of creativity, some fundamentals of disruption, some fundamentals of there are stages to breaking a band or a brand. There's a lifespan to all of these things, and that community is a critical part of everything. Don't look at your neighbor as a competitor. Look at them as an asset who can help share what they've learned on their path. Hopefully our students can come from any of these programs and wherever they choose, and we know life can cause a veer or a change, and you go in a different direction, and that can be just as equally beautiful as making music and making art. Hopefully, they're walking away with these tools of creativity, resilience, and problem solving, because no matter who you are, that's what it is in America today.
I just want to add, as you're sharing that story, I instantly go think about my students now at Berkeley, and I think about the fact that the way that the online world is structured, my students submit their work to me, right? And I have to grade it and I have to look at it, but it's an open form so that literally I have student A who submits his assignment and student B can look at it and he can read it. Now, since these are, each student has to submit their own work and therefore you can't really copy your classmate, it sets up, and I say it in my first class to them, it's setting up that I want them to learn from each other because it is a situation of collaborative learning, and I want them to learn from each other. And we're in a point in time, I think, where I feel more energized to watch the collaborative nature of how do we problem solve? How do we be creative? How do we help each other along through this path? Because at the end of the day, they're still responsible for their own well-being. They're still responsible for their own artistry. But I love that concept of coming together both for creativity and entrepreneurship. Like, there's nobody that I'm going to teach and they're going to go down the exact same path and then fight for each other. There's just not. And for that matter, do you know of bands that truly are enemies with each other anymore? It's like, you used to hear about, like, think about Blur and Oasis in the 90s, you know, I don't hear of any bands that feud like that anymore, because the reality is we're all supportive. And we were sharing earlier, it's like, whether you like a band, I know we were making fun of, or there was, you know, they're making fun of Nickelback and making fun of Linkin Park or whatever, you know, but you take a step back and you're like, whether you like those bands or not, you have to, at some point, as an entrepreneur and as a music fan, you have to appreciate that if they have fans and they're serving them, give them the nod. They're doing something right. Or they built a business like Linkin Park. We were talking earlier. It's like they built a business outside of their music business, VC and funding and starting this business or that. It's like that I have to applaud as an entrepreneur. It's like, that's amazing they're doing that. That's great. But it's all the, once again, it's a collaborative and it's creative.
So this is not the pulpit for this conversation, but if we want to talk about education in a major level and we want to talk about ed tech, it's all the things that you just mentioned, Jay. Ed tech and pedagogy does not mean give everybody an iPad. I love my iPad, but it's not the platform that we need to be teaching young people of every persuasion. It is collaboration. It is problem solving. And it is, okay, so, you know, Billy puts in the paper first. It's the reality that there are people out there setting a bar and you've got to follow that. And what are you going to do with that pressure and that excitement and that freedom to try and inspire yourself to you know, punch above your weight and hit something bigger. Again, solving education wasn't the purview of this conversation, but I'm reminded, you know, partly from Panos's panel and all the other things debated at FMC, the fundamentals of creativity, collaboration, community, problem solving, these are the deep educational pursuits that all of our young people need to follow, not simply platform and not simply a piece of tech.
So Scott, Jay, I'd love to hear any final thoughts you had about, you know, what you learned at the summit, you know, what got talked about, and, you know, what you're excited to bring back to your communities, bring back to your classrooms.
The fights, the challenges always seem singular. You're always alone. You know, you're an educator. You're preparing to walk into a room and there's, you know, how many eyeballs staring at you. I hadn't met Jay before today. I'm reminded the power of camaraderie. I'm reminded the power of meeting and sharing with your colleagues, whether it's through professional affiliations, whether it's through conferences. This is how we all learn together. This is how we all solve together. And speaking as an educator was pretty powerful, to connect with people from Berkeley, connect with people like Anna from Georgetown. This was a great couple of days to share and to question. You know, and to be reminded, we're not all in this in isolation. That's my biggest takeaway. Community, 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 open door, open gate. It's how we all learn and grow.
And for me, it was that sense of kind of what you're saying, Scott. It's like, we're not in this alone. I mean, we're really not. And there was that beautiful moment of, wow, there's about 200 strong here in this room committed to the future of the music business on different levels with different focuses. But at the end of the day, it's like, we all want to see the community of artists succeed, get paid. We also want to see change happen, because, you know, you can watch one panel and end it and get frustrated because you're hearing there's not a clean database for people to, you know, resource for ISRCs and the song this and that and that. And then you hear people like Jeff Price, who was, you know, gosh, I can't wait to watch that again. And there was literally, I was waiting for someone to throw a chair, right? But that energized me, because listen, whether you like him or not, Jeff Price, he said some things that really do have to be heard. And the solution is not saying, Jeff, you're wrong, like, or you're crazy for thinking that. It's, well, okay, but what makes you say that? And is it worthy of investigating that? And Sharky Laguana was saying, you know, he was talking about the whole concept of, maybe there's another way to look at how to divide the big pie for streaming. And I go, okay, once again, agree with him or disagree with him. I told him after the panel, I'm like, I just love that you're asking the question. I just love that you're bringing it to us, this big forum, 200 strong, that says, hey, listen to what I have to say. Does this make sense to you? Should we be looking at this? And to me, it's that collaborative, as I mentioned earlier, but it's collaborative problem solving, which is exciting. I'm not used to hearing that. And it's like, how do we all come together to problem solve this issue? And it's not pointing the finger. And it goes back to what I said earlier. It's like, it is activism. I'm not going to point the finger at somebody. I'm just going to say, I can make a difference, singular, but that we're all in this together. So it becomes a community.
I really loved one of Jim Griffin's closing statements, which was a Thomas Jefferson quote, that music is lighting one candle with another. That speaks exactly to what Jay was sharing. You know what? The process of musical inspiration is often the things that you've grown up with. It's the other records. It's the other artists. It's the other songwriters that have freaked you out and inspired you as a musician. The same is true for almost any pursuit. Who's come before and how can we honor and recognize what they've done and how can we build on that and share with one each other to continue the conversation? That's what I'm reminded from both of you. And thank you both for this time tonight and the last couple of days. It's this sense of camaraderie that I'm excited to bring home. Thank you.
So Scott and Jay, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been awesome hanging out with you at the conference. Scott, if people want to look you up online and find you, where can they do that?
At Scott Laguerre is an easy one on Twitter. And I'm starting to collect and save everything I read and muse about on Pinterest. No, Pinterest is not just for shopping lists. So Pinterest.com/Scott Laguerre, you'll see my music and media list. And so far, it's 1,900 of the articles that I've read and really taken stock of in just the last year. So that for me is becoming a repository. And after that, who knows, Kyle, you'll be the first to know.
Jay, how about you? Where can people find you online?
You can find me at MusicGeekJay, and that's both mostly on Twitter and on Instagram. Those are going to be the two tools to connect with me. And also, I still use LinkedIn a lot, and I do think that that's a tool. For me, I like to see where people have come from, where their specialties are, and maybe how we can connect, once again, that whole collaborative mentality. So look me up at LinkedIn, too. It's literally just Jay Coyle.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.